You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2022, January 2023 combined issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. In the cut, Peter Marino, consummate architect of luxury shopping, from the Dior flagship to a Louis Vuitton handbag, indulges in black leather, black coffee, Beethoven, and Brahms. Style file, daily uniform, black leather. I ride a motorcycle to the office and got tired of changing out of my gear. Karl Lagerfeld told me it was a good look, so I kept it. Favorite accessory? The Artie Capuchin's bag that I designed for Louis Vuitton. I was inspired by a medieval box I saw in Venice. On self-care, skin, Moroccan oil on my tattoos, cologne, Echt Kölnisch Wasser, workout, tennis if it's summer, skiing if it's winter, weights all year. At work, recent project, Cheval Blanc Paris Dior on Avenue Montaigne. Beloved era in architecture, Weiner Werkstatt, 1903. For pleasure reading, Greek and Roman history. Doing, I'm obsessed with gardening and Sudoku. I go to art galleries every Saturday, and pinball is great. Watching, hockey, tennis, CNBC, HBO miniseries. Enjoying, I'm mad for the dahlias I grow in my Southampton gardens. Listening to Wagner, Mozart, Franz, Ravel, Scribin, Liszt, Handel, Lully, Gluck, Beethoven, and Brahms. The menu, morning beverage, black coffee, power snack, almonds, takeout order, Peking duck, Mr. Chow. Gift guide, best gift you've ever received, a gold table from Claude Lalanne. For the aesthete, Peter Marino, the architecture of Chanel. On your wish list, the opportunity to visit the Prince of Liechtenstein's bronze collection. For the interiors enthusiast, try my bronze boxes. Three in a long row look really good. firebrand. SCOTUS is in a right-wing chokehold, but a liberal conservationist judge blazed the activism trail, by Douglas Brinkley. Opening photo, Robert F. Kennedy and William O. Douglas hiking in Washington State, 1962. The conservatives on the U.S. Supreme Court are considered by many to be ardent activists, and yet, truth be told, there has never been a more activist justice than William O. Douglas. Appointed by Franklin D. Roosevelt, Douglas was a committed conservationist, vocal opponent of the Vietnam War, best-selling author, would-be candidate for president, and at 36-plus years, the longest-serving high court justice in American history. With all the current hand-wringing about the politicization of the judiciary, Douglas was Exhibit A in pushing his own political agenda as a liberal, libertarian, and crusading environmentalist. By 1954, Douglas had been on the court for 15 years. A native of Minnesota and Washington State, he pursued his passion for nature and for protecting the American outdoors. Between cases, he plotted campaigns to preserve Washington's North Cascades, Alaska's Arctic, Wyoming's Wind River region, and Maine's Allegash River watershed. His criticism of the government's nuclear testing in the Nevada desert was unrelenting. From his chambers, he investigated the howling range of coyotes and the mysteries of the ruffed grouse. He liked to quip that he would have gladly traded the honor of being on the court for that of having collected ferns for Lewis and Clark. The justice sometimes wore his lug-soled hiking boots on the bench. On weekends, armed with a backpack, binoculars, and floppy hat, Douglas, compact and trim with fierce blue eyes, would explore the backcountry of Virginia or Maryland, sometimes with his longtime protege Robert F. Kennedy as his trail mate. In the 50s, as the post-war car boom surged and an environmental crisis loomed, the vexing threat to air quality posed by leaded gas. Douglas was alarmed by the smog-shrouded dome that hung over cities like Los Angeles and New York. Decrying consumer consumption run amok, he blasted the Army for selling surplus Jeeps in the arid West, which, when driven off-road on public lands, damaged soil, streams, plants, and habitats. He encouraged fellow proto-environmentalists to use lawsuits as a weapon against the Army Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Reclamation, and British extraction companies. Furious at the reckless wounding of the earth by Philistines, he would help the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society, he was a member of both, acquire pro bono attorneys for their preservationist pursuits. En route to the court, Douglas would sometimes ask his chauffeur to drive along the Potomac so he could check for traces of manganese, a heavy metal used in industrial processes that can cause neurological damage to humans and wildlife. Richard Schwartz, a Yale law professor, recalled that his friend Douglas was distraught over the way the Department of Agriculture and the Corps of Engineers operated without accountability. Douglas carped that the Forest Service was a faceless organization full of modern Ahabs, hungry for money and power as the agency opened wild areas to roads, mineral extraction, and timber cutting. "I'm ready to bend the law," he said, "in favor of the environment and against the corporations." Spending long stretches in the North Cascades and fly fishing in Oregon brought equilibrium to Douglas's pressured life. And when his close friend in the Senate, John F. Kennedy, had a question about nesting plovers or pollution abatement, he looked to Douglas, who often teased, "The trouble is, Jack, that you've never slept on the ground." Unafraid of conflict of interest charges, Douglas turned his Supreme Court office into a way station for elite conservation groups. Douglas had grown incensed about a proposed Virginia-Maryland motorway along the bed of the abandoned Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. He charged that a paved road would create abominable traffic and ruin the towpath. The noise, he fumed, would destroy the tranquility of a hike along the old canal, a project first championed by George Washington. The National Park Service was in favor of the parkway, but wanted to ban commercial activity along the route. Douglas envisioned a meandering national parkland at the back door of the nation's capital. The opening salvo of the battle over the C&O Canal began in January 1954 with a Washington Post editorial by Associate Editor Merlo Pusey, supporting the motorway. Douglas wrote the Post that a multiple-lane road would destroy the scenic Potomac Valley. The keynotes of the wood thrush would be drowned out by a cacophony of roaring wheels and blaring horns. Soon, an anti-construction sign was posted by preservationist at Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Justice Douglas, keep to the right, booby traps to the left, or for the Post editors. Douglas decided to throw down a gauntlet. He challenged the Post editorial board to hike the towpath with him, to experience firsthand the beauty of Great Falls and Mather Gorge, which the parkway would ostensibly destroy. One who walked the canal its full length, Douglas wrote, would get to know muskrats, badgers, and fox. The whistling wings of ducks would make silence have new values for him. He could never acquire that understanding going 60 or even 25 miles an hour. To their credit, Robert Estabrook, the Post editorial page editor, and his associate editor, Pusey, accepted the challenge to make the 8-day, 184-mile hike. On March 20th, a party of 37 joined the Justice. Among their number was Sigurd Olson, the director of the National Parks Association and a legendary advocate of the outdoors, who had a degree in a new field, ecology. Also on hand was Olaus Murie of the Wilderness Society. A renowned conservationist, Murie would regularly correspond with Douglas about an initiative he had undertaken to stop hydroelectric dams. Reporters from Time, Life, and CBS Radio followed the delegation along the Potomac. The Washington Post covered the outing daily. The nightly news ran favorable segments. The Potomac Appalachian Trail Club of Washington supplied the team with food. Enjoying the blush of buds blooming in late winter, the group followed Douglas's pace of 112 steps per minute, marching 22 miles the first day. The New York Times dubbed them the Blister Brigade. Driving downpours and frigid wind didn't hamper the nature lovers, who encouraged gaggles of Boy Scouts, fishermen, and nearby equestrians to join their cause. Douglas's merry band encountered raccoons, woodchucks, and hawks circling for prey. Otter prints were discovered along the riverbank. One evening, some of the hikers decided to play a joke on Murie, considered the country's expert on animal tracks. Clandestinely, a Mexican burro was brought to the trail to leave telltale hoof prints. Early the following morning, Murie, upon seeing the tracks, was taken aback. Then to the stunned group, he nailed it, saying, "If it weren't for the fact that there aren't any for hundreds of miles, I'd say it was a Mexican burro." Near journey's end, Estabrook and Pusey quit the march, exhausted. But Douglas, despite a rending cough, forged onward with eight others in scudding rain. Once back in Georgetown, his Blister Brigade told a welcome home party of 50,000 about eating buffalo steak and sleeping in frost-caked tents. Editors Estabrook and Pusey had a change of heart. The Post retracted its editorial, suggesting that parts of the canal should be saved as a federal park. Soon the Park Service withdrew its support as well. Douglas's Odyssey had helped derail the motorway, and in the months to follow, his widely publicized style of direct action was adopted in local battles around the country. Protest hikes were organized. Anti-dam rallies were held. Citizens and politicians were on the march. Just days before leaving office in January 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who quietly admired Douglas's feistiness, surprised conservationists by designating the C&O Canal a national monument, a stepping stone to its becoming a national historical park. And in 1975, Douglas retired from the bench at age 77, having written 30 books on travel and the environment, all published while he generated more opinions and dissents than any other justice in the history of the court. With hardly a murmur of criticism in the national press, Douglas's sustained policy activism outside his chambers is without precedent. By hiking and hollering, as he put it, his Gandhian protest and other demonstrations that followed had helped establish green belts, nature preserves, and open spaces across the land. This latter-day Gandhi, of course, wore not a white dhoti and shawl. He preferred black robes and hiking boots. Excerpted from Silent Spring Revolution, John F. Kennedy, Rachel Carson, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and the Great Environmental Awakening by Douglas Brinkley, to be published on November 15, 2022 by HarperCollins. Copyright 2022 by Douglas Brinkley. Winning Friends, Influencing People, how J.J. Redick has gone from being one of basketball's most hated players to one of its most beloved commentators, by Eve Pizer. Opening photo shows Redick with cityscape in the background. It was close to midnight on a warm night in June, and Kendrick Perk Perkins had a confession to make. He was recording an episode of The Old Man and the Three, the wildly popular podcast hosted by J.J. Redick, the retired NBA player, and Tommy Alter, a TV producer. Perkins used to be a center for the Boston Celtics, and at 6 feet 10 and upwards of 300 pounds, he makes the 6 feet 4 Redick look petite. Perkins, Redick, and Alter, who at 5 feet 11 would look regular size, if not tall, in virtually any other context, are seated in Alter's living room in Dumbo, sipping on glasses of a 2008 Chambertin Grand Cru that runs around $4,000 a bottle. After they finish recording the podcast, Redick, a wine aficionado, tells me it was just okay, nothing special. Right before the podcast recording, Perkins had been at the Barclays Center rehearsing for the live 2022 NBA draft, which would air the following evening on ESPN, where he and Redick are both analysts. In a full suit and tie, he looked ready for prime time. Redick was dressed down in a backward old man and the three cap, gray skinny jeans and a white tee, revealing his bevy of Christian tattoos. His left arm features a sleeve of the four authors of the Gospels, Matthew, winged and haloed, and below that, Mark, Luke, and John, in the forms of various flying animals. Perkins gets on with his confession. Way back in 2008, when his Celtics were playing LeBron James's Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference semifinals, I was like, let us get breaking news that LeBron has tore his ACL or something, Perkins says, pantomiming shame. I did, bro. Like, I'm not even lying. I'm not even exaggerating. Redick looks at Kylie Kilgore, the COO of his production company, with Alter 342, who is sitting off to the side. We have to edit this out, Redick says. Kilgore happens to be the twin sister of Redick's wife, Chelsea, as well as Redick's own best friend. No, you can't edit this out, Perkins protests. This is real. That's how terrified I was of LeBron. When the podcast drops days later, the anecdote stays in and gets picked up around the sports world. This sort of moment, after all, is why listeners like The Old Man and the Three. It's not every day that you hear a professional athlete talk about how he was so thirsty for a championship ring and under so much insane pressure that he asked God to cripple his opponent. But Redick, who started podcasting in 2016 and retired from the NBA after the 2020-2021 season, is a gifted interviewer, able to coax his podcast guest, mostly former and current NBA players, into opening up. Sometimes too much. Redick was concerned about the backlash Perkins might receive for his audacious confession, which is why his initial impulse was to cut it. Because I'm a peer, because we share a lot of the same experiences, there's an inherent respect level, Redick tells me, a few days later, over lunch at Nini's Deli Taqueria in Bushwick. I'm able to ask questions that if a reporter were to ask that, or if traditional media were to ask that, I don't think you'd get the same response. That's the advantage of our show. Being a professional athlete is deeply unrelatable. You're inconceivably rich, inconceivably recognizable, and you possess an inconceivable physical agility. But when Redick talks to other athletes, he humanizes them. His podcast paints a compelling portrait of the emotional cost of spending half your year traveling away from your family, the pressures of the spotlight, the relentless drive you need to truly master your craft. Redick arrives at Nini's fresh off of an E-Span hit, wearing a tailored navy suit, aviator sunglasses hanging from his shirt, his hair slightly gray and duly styled. He never talks with his mouth full or dribbles juices and salsa down his immaculate getup. He takes a picture with one fan, says hi to the family of another on FaceTime, and he shares a warm familiarity with the restaurant staff. It's hard not to think, wow, everyone freaking loves this guy. It wasn't always like this. Before the Orlando Magic drafted Redick in 2006, back when he was a shooting guard at Duke, the basketball world despised him, or so it seemed. He is widely considered to be one of the most hated college players of all time. We used to make fun of him all the time at Deadspin. We all thought he was just another snotty Duke white dude, Will Leach, the website's founding editor, says. One post on the website declared him America's dumbest student athlete, while another wondered if the fact that he cried during his final Duke game meant that he was a wimp with a weak disposition. He turned out to be a little more interesting than that. Leach no longer has any animosity toward Redick, but he doesn't necessarily regret those snarky blogs. I think everybody is different than they were 15 years ago, including Redick, he says. He's matured. The internet has sort of matured. We've all matured. For some reason, there's always a white Duke player who everyone hates, Josh Hart theorizes over the phone. Hart grew up a University of Maryland fan, and thus, he says, I hated him. But Hart, a shooting guard and small forward for the Portland Trail Blazers, ultimately developed a close friendship with Redick when they played together on the New Orleans Pelicans. A confluence of factors turned Redick into a national villain during his time at Duke. Chief among them, Duke itself, perhaps the most hated college basketball program in the country. They reeked of entitlement and embodied everything so many people despised in a way that went beyond sports. They had an air about them like I'm better than you, retired NBA player Eaton Thomas explained in a Guardian op-ed in 2019. Not just on the basketball court, but as human beings, just overall elitist. E-Span writer Bomani Jones put it more succinctly, if Duke played the Ku Klux Klan, I'd root for a 0-0 tie. That line, though, is from an article Jones wrote in the early 2000s imploring college basketball fans to stop hating on Redick. He looks like what so many people associate with Duke, unathletic white players who are pumped up illegitimately by a fawning media. And it's safe to say that's what so many people hate, Jones wrote. But if my fellow Duke haters aren't careful, they'll miss their chance to appreciate one of the best shooters in recent memory. He was the best college basketball player in America while being a white player who played for Duke. That, by definition, was going to make him a polarizing figure, says Jones now. He is friendly with Redick and appeared on his podcast in 2020. That defense of the Duke shooting guard made such a splash at the time, Jones tells me, that it effectively launched his own sports journalism career. Other Duke players riled the nation before and after Redick. Perhaps the most infamous was Christian Laettner, handsome, white, perennially smug-looking, who played for the private North Carolina College in the late 80s and early 90s. Before Laettner, in the 80s, Blue Devil Danny Ferry drew widespread ire. More recently, Grayson Allen, who had a nasty habit of appearing to trip his opponents, took the cake. During Redick's time at Duke, from 2002 to 2006, he was relentlessly bullied by fans from opposing teams and the sports media. Whenever he'd shoot a free throw, the crowd would chant, F-U-J-J, Redick wrote in a 2017 op-ed that some fans had speckled their shoulders with red dots to mock his acne, and he said that someone once held up a sign saying they had sex with his then 12-year-old sister. shortly before the 2006 draft, when Reddick was charged with a DWI, Leach categorized the public response to one of Reddick's lowest points as unbridled glee. In a blog mocking Reddick's collegiate poetry, A.J. Delario, writing for Deadspin, said, J.J.'s entries make insane clown Pisces miracles read like ode on a Grecian urn. A few of Reddick's verses. No bandage can cover my scars. It's hard living a life behind invisible bars. Searching for the face of God, I'm only inspired by the poems of Nas. And I can't see what my future has in store, but I move forth with the strength of a condor, the courage of a warrior, the commitment of an American soldier. Reddick now clarifies that he wrote these lyrics less as poems and more as rap lyrics. It was terrible poetry, and it was very much subpar rap lyrics, he says, laughing. But Reddick's college era put him in a unique position when he went pro. He had nowhere to go but up. All he had to do was leave Duke, Jones says, comparing Reddick's trajectory to that of legendary Knicks player Patrick Ewing. When Patrick Ewing was at Georgetown, Georgetown was seen as being the blackest college basketball program, which scared the hell out of a lot of people. Patrick Ewing was despised by a significant portion of America, he says. Nobody hated Patrick Ewing as an NBA player because it was never actually about Patrick Ewing. It was about where he fit into something larger. When the Magic drafted Reddick, his relationship with the media and the general public initially remained combative. I certainly felt like, in my first 2 years, there was a large contingent of basketball fans that were excited about my struggles and rooting for my demise, Reddick says. It was after his third or fourth year in the league, he reckons, that the public began to warm to him. I proved I could be a rotation player at the very least in the NBA. Throughout his career, Reddick built a reputation as a reliable three-point shooter. He has the 18th highest three-point percentage of all time. I knew that people didn't like him at Duke, but I just always thought of him as a shooter. He was just the guy who was a sniper, Alter tells me. Once we got to know each other, I got to see, like, I've never met anyone like him in terms of his ability to communicate. While someone like Leitner was never quite able to shake his reputation because his career was mostly disappointing, the antipathy toward Reddick faded away as he exceeded people's expectations. In the 2008 to 2009 season, he helped the Magic make it to the NBA Finals, the team's first and only appearance there since the Shaq era. Several years later, he was a pivotal piece on one of the best Clippers teams ever, averaging 15.8 points per game and making 44% of his three-point shots during his four seasons in Los Angeles. To contextualize just how impressive that is, Steph Curry, the best three-point shooter of all time, has landed 42.8% of his attempts from deep throughout his career. And now, in the past 6 or so years, thanks to his podcasting and television persona, Reddick has been wholly embraced by casual and hardcore NBA fans alike. On television, he took on a role that the general public has an affection for, which is, he is the guy calling us being media professionals, on our shit, Jones says. And people really enjoy watching players turn it back around on media pundits. On The Old Man and the Three, as well as on earlier iterations on Yahoo Sports and The Ringer, Reddick exudes authenticity. He is nice, he is funny, he is emotionally available. The podcast has that it factor. The listener feels in on a conversation among friends. I don't think of myself as beloved, but I do acknowledge that there is some weird arc that has happened with the perception of my personality, Reddick tells me. I don't ever feel like I've been victimized by the media. Most anything that has ever been written about me, I've probably brought on myself, he says. You know, I've effed up a lot in my life. Dude, there were some dark times. I remember being like, F man, I don't feel like I'm a bad person. And then the other part of that was that I acted like a dickhead and probably accelerated the hatred and animosity towards me. Said dickhead behavior, according to Reddick, included bobbing my head, smiling. Yes, I occasionally talked trash to student sections, people on the front row and visiting arenas, but I was doing that in response. I was trying to create a persona. Reddick says he behaved that way at Duke because he was young and immature and not really understanding what was happening and not being comfortable with myself. So he began going to therapy every week after his sophomore year of college. I read a ton on consciousness and flow state and insecurities, and I just got to a place where I was comfortable with who I was, he says. It became this really diligent obsession with what I can control. That's why my routine is so important. My sleep became so important. The exact amount of shots I take every Sunday became so important to me, he tells me. All this other stuff has no effect on my day-to-day life. By the time Reddick became a veteran in the league, he was a leader in the locker room, someone younger players looked up to. Hart recalls Reddick holding a team meeting in New Orleans during a moment when they were struggling. He held us accountable and demanded more from us on the court, but also not being on our phones, being more connected, and those sorts of things, Hart tells me. I vividly remember this because it showed the leadership he had, the accountability he had. Everyone came out of that meeting in a positive way because it wasn't just a veteran guy who was talking to us. It was JJ, someone who puts the work in. Reddick announced his retirement last September after 15 years in the NBA. He now splits his time between podcasting and being an ESPN analyst, which is an interesting role for a person who was antagonized by the media the moment he stepped on the court. His experience at Duke, he tells me, profoundly impacted the way he understood what it means to be famous. When he was in college, Twitter didn't exist, and he didn't have a microphone to talk into for an hour. His media career has allowed him to take control of his own narrative and also the narrative about other players. In an appearance on ESPN's First Take earlier this year, Reddick went viral when he called out fellow commentator Christopher Mad Dog Russo. Russo had been particularly offended by Draymond Green's behavior while the Golden State Warriors power forward was playing the Memphis Grizzlies in the Western Conference semifinals. After Green got elbowed in the face and started bleeding, the Memphis crowd erupted in cheers. In response, he flipped them off and defended his behavior in his post-game press conference. On the show, Russo said that America's tired of Draymond Green and he should just shut up and play. That has the same sort of connotation that the shut up and dribble crowd has towards athletes, and I have a real problem with that. The people on Fox News talk about them that way, Reddick said. People want to hear what Draymond has to say because he is real, authentic, and unfiltered. I tell Reddick that because of this moment, my friend's brother referred to him as the woke guy from ESPN. I am not woke. I don't consider myself to be woke, Reddick maintains. What happened with Mad Dog, I don't think what he said was right. I wanted to point out why it was wrong. It's that simple. He might not identify as woke, but Reddick is by no means apolitical. After the 2016 election, he began publicly commenting on presidential politics, speaking out against Donald Trump, not infrequently. I'm about as anti-Trump as you can get, he said, during a post-game press conference in 2017. That same year, he told the Los Angeles Times that he was horrified by Trump and by the prospect of Americans losing their health care and women losing their right to decide what to do with their body. I'm a registered Democrat, I believe in science. I believe in trying to treat people with respect, and I believe in not grifting people, he tells me. While he wasn't particularly involved in politics pre-2016, he's had a long-standing interest in the intersection between sports and social justice. Sports and politics have always been intertwined, Reddick says. His heroes are Tommy Smith and John Carlos, the two black athletes who raised their fist during the medal ceremony at the 1968 Olympics and were expelled from the team and the Olympic Village in response. They risk everything, and they were just effing ostracized from the U.S. track and field community. And they paid the price for that for years and years and years, he tells me. Politics and sports? Come on, that's not an effing new thing. When it comes to contemporary sports politics issues, Reddick leans leftward. I support trans athletes, he tells me. It goes back to just a basic level of empathy. They want to be able to compete. They should be able to compete. Colin Kaepernick, for a number of years, he deserved a spot on a roster and didn't have that opportunity. Green, who solicited Reddick's advice on podcasting while interviewing Reddick on his own show, often talks about this idea of the new media, which is made up of athletes like himself and Reddick, a new generation of sports media talking heads who approach analysis from the perspective of the player. During a live recording of The Old Man and the Three in June, Green anointed Reddick as the leader of the new media. While retired athletes have built second careers in sports analysis for many years, the sports media radically changed during Reddick's tenure as a professional athlete. Debating something like whether LeBron James or Michael Jordan is a better basketball player, which happens on ESPN and social media frequently, is about lifting one person up and pushing another person down, Reddick says. It's total bullshit. During the 2020 to 2021 NBA season, Reddick was traded from New Orleans to the Dallas Mavericks. He knew he was going to get traded, but he had asked to be sent somewhere closer to his family in Brooklyn and was dismayed to find himself so far away from his wife and children. You're giving up some autonomy by being an NBA player. By and large, the good far outweighs the bad, he tells me. Anytime any athlete complains about anything, the immediate response, it drives me crazy, is like, shut up, you're getting paid a lot of money. It's just dehumanizing. When the season ended, Reddick decided to retire. Although he had hoped to win a championship before leaving the league, he tells me that treatment on his Achilles tendon failed, so he wouldn't have been able to play anyway, and he wanted to be around to take his kids to school. Last September, he publicly announced his retirement in an emotional video he released on the Old Man and the Three YouTube channel. Recording that podcast where I retired, we obviously had to cut out me sobbing hysterically like 20 times, he tells me. In his new life, he has retained his competitive spirit. I want to be really great at something. I want to win, he says. I don't know how you win in media, but I'll figure it out. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Hugh Jackman, the award-winning actor and star of The Sun, on birthday presents, the ocean, and his love for Bill Nye. What is your greatest extravagance? Food. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Seaweed. I love the ocean. It would be nice to float around and then sometimes wash onto shore. Which living person do you most admire? Michelle Obama. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? When I poll the audience and my need to please others. When and where were you happiest? The birth of my children. Which talent would you most like to have? To cook. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Jean Valjean. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Indecisiveness. It can be really annoying, especially when I am out to dinner and can't decide between the chicken or the fish. What is the trait you most deplore in others? When people talk over others. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Seeing my family thrive and being underwater. What is your greatest fear? Fear itself. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My son and daughter. What is your favorite journey? Inward. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Kindness. On what occasion do you lie? When someone asks, do I look good in this? What do you dislike most about your appearance? My feet. Which living person do you most despise? No one. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Sensational and awesome. What is your greatest regret? Not listening to my gut. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My children and my wife. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? More time together. What is your most treasured possession? The 3 books my wife made me for my 50th. They encapsulate my life to that point. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Loneliness. Where would you like to live? Sydney, and of course New York City. What is your favorite occupation? Acting. Who are your heroes in real life? Ken Burns, Bill Nye. What is your most marked characteristic? Openness. What do you most value in your friends? Honesty and loyalty. Who are your favorite writers? Herman Hesse, Richard Powers. What are your favorite names? Olivia and Caitlin. What is it that you most dislike? Cruelty and liver. How would you like to die? Peacefully in my sleep, but not yet, please. What is your motto? If it scares you, say yes. What is your current state of mind? Contemplative. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Hugh Jackman. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.